supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. John Carney took the oath of office to become Delaware's 74th governor outside Legislative Hall in Dover today. Details from WHYY's Zoe Reed.
Standing in the rain, Carney pledged to work with private investors to create jobs, provide skills training to young people, and take a new approach to economic development.
Our administration will work to lead our state through a transition to an innovation economy, where we're not only the first state when it comes to incorporating a company, but also the first state when it comes to growing a company and deepening its roots here in Delaware.
Carney says he'll work with newly elected Wilmington Mayor Mike Przycki and Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer to address crime.
In the short term, we will get serious about crime and target resources to the most crime-ridden neighborhoods, and we will better prepare ex-offenders to come back to the community.
Carney says his administration will partner with teachers and parents to improve education, and he vows to address a $350 million budget deficit. Republican State Senator Ernie Lopez says Carney, a Democrat, addressed the state's immediate needs and challenges.
We're facing a tremendous fiscal deficit, and I was very pleased to hear his remarks in regards to finding bipartisan solutions to the problems that are facing each and every Delawarean, from Newcastle to Sussex, where I represent.
Former Governor Ruth Ann Minner, who Carney served as lieutenant governor, says he's more than prepared to serve.
He's got a plan. He knows what he wants to do. And knowing John, he will do it.
Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall Long also was sworn into office during the ceremony. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
There were inaugurations in Pennsylvania today as well. Democrat Josh Shapiro was sworn in as Attorney General, promising to run the office with integrity. Shapiro is the third person to serve as Attorney General since Democrat Kathleen Kane resigned last year after being convicted of leaking secret material and then lying about it. Democrats also hold the state's other two row offices. Eugene DePasquale, a former state representative from York, embarks on a second term as Auditor General. Joe Torsella, formerly a deputy mayor in Philadelphia and chief executive of the National Constitution Center, is the state's new treasurer. With Friday's inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump approaching, our commentator Solomon Jones has been reflecting on the impending departure of President Barack Obama. He's also been remembering how those who gave their all in the struggle for civil rights resulted in the U.S.'s first African-American commander-in-chief, and so Trump's dismissive comments about Congressman John Lewis have been especially jarring for him.
The recent exchanges between the president-elect, civil rights icon John Lewis, and celebrity Steve Harvey were of particular interest to me. In watching Trump engage with these two very different black men, I saw for myself the tenuous nature of King's dream of racial equality. I saw for myself how easily that dream can be destroyed. Trump's first interaction took place via Twitter. That's where he insulted Representative John Lewis after the Georgia congressman dared to lend voice to what many Americans now suspect, that Russian interference has called the legitimacy of Trump's presidency into question. Trump responded that Lewis is all talk and no action, that his Atlanta congressional district is crime-ridden and neglected. But Lewis's life says the opposite. Last year, Lewis led a sit-in on the House floor while attempting to force a vote on gun control. And in the 1960s, Lewis risked his life to participate in freedom rides that challenged segregation in the South. He suffered a cracked skull at the hands of Alabama state troopers while helping to lead the Selma Voting Rights March that came to be known as Bloody Sunday. As a result of Lewis's actions, African Americans won the very voting rights that Trump now mocks in speeches. Moreover, Lewis's 5th congressional district, which encompasses much of Atlanta and contains airports, universities, and corporate offices, is not the crime-ridden place that Trump portrays it to be. But Lewis is apparently not worthy of Trump's respect. Comedian and radio TV host Steve Harvey is another matter entirely. He reaches millions through a daily syndicated radio show, a TV talk show, as host of the Family Feud game show, and as an author and producer of books and movies. Harvey trekked to Trump Tower to meet with Donald Trump over the weekend for what he said was a meeting about housing. But as I looked at images of Harvey and Trump standing together and read Harvey's statement calling Trump a sincere man who wants to help inner cities, I came to believe the meeting served as a tacit endorsement. I'm wary of Trump's support of stop and frisk, a policing tactic ruled unconstitutional because it targets people of color. I'm troubled that Trump spent 5 years questioning the citizenship of the nation's first black president. But most of all, I'm disappointed that Steve Harvey, a man who is a trusted voice for millions of black listeners and viewers, would use his celebrity to endorse Donald Trump before Trump has lifted a finger to help black people. In the words of slave-turned-abolitionist Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. To be frank, we must demand more from our president-elect than photo ops with black celebrities. Because if Donald Trump respects the work of black entertainers more than he respects the legacy of black freedom fighters, then power has conceded nothing. We've moved backward on the issue of race, and true unity is much farther away than we thought. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog at newsworks.org. Officials in Philadelphia are also anticipating the Trump administration with some concern. They've surveyed the federal funding the city relies on that could be affected by the new president's policies. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that while the city is not making contingency plans yet, some advocates think it should be.
Finance Director Rob Dubo asked Philadelphia departments to figure out how much city spending relies on money from Washington. The answer?
Maybe around 10% of overall spending.
Donald Trump has threatened to eliminate funding for so-called sanctuary cities like Philadelphia that don't routinely fulfill immigration detainer requests. And Dubo says there are worries about the impact of his policies on health, education, and infrastructure.
Some of the things they've said, are concerning, but until you actually see the administration come in and you see what legislation happens, you can't really say what's going to happen with specificity.
So Dubo says the city's taking a wait-and-see approach, not making contingency plans yet. Robert Field, a Drexel Health policy expert, says there's more to consider here than just federal funding streams for city services, such as the prospect of reversing the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act.
If that rug were pulled out from people, you'd have a lot of people who are way too poor to buy health insurance, who don't have jobs that offer health insurance, and would have no way to get it. A lot of those people would need to go to city public health clinics because they wouldn't be able to afford private physicians.
Donna Cooper, Executive Director of Public Citizens for Children and Youth, says the city needs to think proactively about what might be coming from Washington.
I think it's important that there are preemptive messages that explain to the public what's at risk, so that the public can engage and make sure their elected officials, Senators Casey and Toomey, their House members, are protecting the city of Philadelphia.
Dubo says city officials will see what unfolds in the next couple of months. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Protesters of a ban on sitting on walls of Rittenhouse Square have won a victory after Mayor Jim Kenney reversed the rule in the wake of public outcry. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the wall-sitting prohibition set off a discussion about race and class.
The 3-foot concrete walls surrounding the park's fountain are more popular than the rows of benches. Visitors have congregated on the park's walls for generations. Among them, Ursula Corral.
People play chess, they kiss one another, they make love sitting on the wall. It's wonderful.
But Rittenhouse residents were sick of the loiterers and pot smokers among the wall sitters, and they invested heavily in park repairs. So neighbors requested a ban on using the park's walls as a perch, and the city agreed. Richard Branton was pleased.
I mean, what's so magical about sitting on the wall? It provides an opportunity for people with undesirable attentions to pass drugs.
Those kinds of views sparked an outcry on social media. In response, the city quickly took down the no-sitting signs along the walls, and Mayor Kenney tweeted, "Sit where you want." To celebrate, dozens gathered for what they called a sit-in house to show support. Sachi Okoyin was there.
Certainly this little move of not letting people sit on the balustrade or wall, whatever you want to call it, is about race and social class. It's something that was not expected to be noticed. A little tiny thing that's a statement of who belongs here and who doesn't.
During the 60s, Rittenhouse was ground zero for artists and anti-war activists who won a right to be there after a federal judge ruled, quote, it is not a crime to be a hippie. But area resident Vicki Vale cites a shooting that occurred near the park in October that put the community on edge. She says the wall-sitting ban needs to come back.
It's a good idea because we're getting rid of the drugs and all of the hanging out here and smoking pot. That element was not always part of Rittenhouse Square.
I've never seen drug dealers, and I'm here every other day, hours in the summer and the spring.
That's Mina Smith-Siegel, who often paints portraits of people on the wall. But even after the mayor's tweet, private guards hired by the neighbors told me to get off the wall. And those guards, the neighbors say, aren't going away anytime soon. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
A key figure in the battle for women's voting rights, Alice Paul, marched on Washington the day before Woodrow Wilson's first inauguration in 1913. Now, a local teen plans to pay tribute to her hero and bring attention to gender equality by staging a march of her own in Philadelphia the day before Donald Trump takes his oath of office. WHYY's Rob Zavatsky reports.
I started planning this march before I knew who was actually going to be elected. And I mean, this march is bigger than either of the two candidates. It's about women's equality because half of the population isn't considered constitutionally equal.
Anna Holmans is a junior at Friends Select School in Philadelphia. As part of her work to earn a Gold Award, the highest achievement in the Girl Scouts, she decided to recreate the 1913 suffrage parade led by noted women's rights activist Alice Paul, who was born in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Holmans is calling it Alice's March for Equality.
I'm in love with Alice Paul. She's one of my role models, and so continuing her unfinished work is just exciting for me.
Holmans is an active member of the Girls Advisory Council at the Alice Paul Institute in Mount Laurel. Paul was instrumental in the fight for women's voting rights and helped to author the Equal Rights Amendment. In a 1970s interview archived on the Institute's website, Paul says the idea behind the amendment wasn't complicated.
Men and women shall have equal rights throughout the United States and every place subject to its jurisdiction. Because that said it all. And I said, that's what we want. Let's say what we want.
The Institute's executive director, Lucy Beard, says while progress has been made over the years, the fact that the Equal Rights Amendment has never been ratified really drives Holmans to carry on Paul's legacy. Beard says the ERA matters even though there are laws banning discrimination against women.
We live with a constitution that does not guarantee rights regardless of your gender. It literally says all men are created equal. And when you use a word, a gender-specific word like men, it means that women are not included.
To get guidance putting the march together, Holmans turned to Colleen Puckett, the assistant head of School for External Relations at Friends Select. Puckett has a long history of social activism and says Holmans is a natural leader.
People want to follow her. People want to assist and help, and their minds have been open too. So there's a lot of excitement around.
Anna's parents were not surprised when Anna told them she was going to organize a march. They say she's always been passionate about equality. However, her dad Pete says even though Anna may be more engaged and aware than other kids her age, she is still a teenager.
As a father of a 16-year-old daughter, you know, you don't really get much of a statement in what they care about, right? I mean, they're going to care about what they care about. I mean, fortunately for Anna, it's something that we should all care about.
Anna admits planning a march has not been easy. When she started, the idea was to hold it in Washington, but that didn't work.
I've cried so many times about this march just because it's like, okay, well, now I have to switch it to Philadelphia. What does that mean? And just like stress because it's normal school and planning a march, and normally this is a full-time job.
She says her school, the Girl Scouts, and the Alice Paul Institute have been very supportive. But some others doubted her.
People were just like, all right, are you sure you can do this? Are you sure that you can pull this off? Do you know how to get a permit? Stuff like that.
Those closest to Holman say no matter how many people participate, successfully organizing a march like this is a victory. But up until the last minute, she'll be pushing to get more people to march from Philadelphia City Hall down to Aiken's Oval near the Art Museum. For WHYY, I'm Rob Zavatsky.
An aging baby boomer generation is in turn generating demand for housing, accommodating those with progressive neurological disorders. Let's get insight from Teresa Clement. She's a home designer. Teresa, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
How did you come to this specific niche of home design?
Well, my dad had Alzheimer's, and he died just a few months ago. So this is an issue that's extremely personal to me. But as a designer, it's also an issue that's important to me as a professional, too. My dad lived in a continuing care retirement community with my mother, and they moved there because he had Parkinson's disease. And then after they lived there for a while, he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And then after a little while, he was moved into memory care in the nursing home that was on campus. And when he moved there, I started asking questions. Why is the color this? Why is the flooring this? Why is the sign this way? And nobody could really answer my questions. So I tried to find an expert in design for Alzheimer's. I called the Alzheimer's Association locally, and I called nationally. I tried to find somebody who was an expert, and I couldn't. So I decided to take this upon myself to make this a mission, because there are so many families that need this help.
And so is your work primarily in already existing assisted living facilities or home residents?
My focus right now is on homes, because there's 5.3 million people that have Alzheimer's, and 3.9 million of them live at home. And half of them have household incomes of less than $50,000 a year. Now, if you think about being a caregiver and how much time that you have to spend helping somebody that has dementia, and how many work days that you miss, there's a lot of things that you can do that are very simple adjustments to your house using design and very simple remodeling that can put so much more time back in your day, and that you can enjoy the life with your loved one as they progress through the disease.
So you alluded to a few variables. You cited color, for example.
Yes, color is so important, and it's probably the easiest thing that you can do in your home. For example, if you have a white toilet on a white floor with a white wall, which most people do because that's the image that we see in all of the magazines, and a lot of people end up using the wastebasket instead of the toilet because they can see the wastebasket because it's a different color, a different texture, and they can't see the toilet. So by just painting behind the toilet or putting a different color behind the toilet, you've saved yourself so much time. And also, you've also given back something to your loved one who has dementia so that they have a little bit more control and a little bit more self-happiness, because a lot of people who have dementia and Alzheimer's can see once they're through stage one, stage two, they know something's happening. When they get to stage three, they probably don't know what's going on as much, but to give them a little bit of that dignity back, because we have to remember we're caring for people who've lived a full life.
What are some other easy, inexpensive avails for those in the earlier stages of Alzheimer's?
They have trouble finding things in the house. So making sure that there is a color differentiation between the rooms. So making sure that the bathroom door is a different color and that they get used to that as they're going through the first stage of Alzheimer's or dementia, so that they know the blue door is that and they can associate it with that. The thing is that even though they don't have short-term memory, if they do the same thing over and over and over again, it creates a long-term memory. So making sure that they know that door is blue, or that there's a picture of a toilet on the outside of the bathroom. Another really easy thing to do is to take a cabinet door off of one of the cabinets in the kitchen, so that you have their plate, their bowl, their spoon, the things that they need to use in their life. Because when you have dementia, and there are so many cabinet doors and they all look the same, start to forget which one has the plates, which one has the glasses. So making sure that they can find it, just taking the door off, is that it's that easy to give them back a little bit of that in their life.
Teresa Clement, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope that everybody gets inspired by this to help everybody else.
Home designer Teresa Clement, and you can certainly hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. An art gallery in Old City, Philadelphia has been transformed into a doctor's office so that an artist can perform as a doctor for one audience member at a time. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports the artist will see you now.
Emma Sulkowitz will perform her piece called The Healing Touch Integral Wellness Clinic 130 times in 3 weeks. Each performance is a half-hour appointment with an individual, kind of like a therapy session, and it's based on a fairly personal questionnaire that the patient fills out beforehand. The stated intention of the clinic is to cure you of your desires. Sulkowitz says the whole premise is merely a jumping-off point to be able to talk about why people seek out art in the first place.
I'm interested in what kinds of desires are we seeking to fulfill when we go to the museum, when we go to a gallery, when we go to even a theater show. What are we doing?
Sulkowitz achieved notoriety a few years ago for a performance piece called Carry That Weight, or The Mattress Performance. While a senior at Columbia University, she carried a mattress everywhere she went for the whole year. It was meant to bring attention to the university's refusal to expel her accused rapist, a fellow student. The university could not find enough evidence to convict. The controversial performance was the centerpiece of a national conversation about sexual assault on college campuses and, as a backlash, the right of the accused to innocence until proven guilty. During the mattress performance, Sulkowitz was constantly approached by total strangers who wanted to share their intimate problems with her. Sometimes they would spontaneously reach out and touch her. She says it was kind of creepy.
To me, often even felt like I was like this healing object. People would touch me as if it could heal them. And at first I was really upset, but I'm like, well, maybe I have to understand that people have a need, right? People need to be healed.
The wellness clinic is her response to that perceived need. Each of the one-on-one performances is tailored to the individual who made the appointment. Sulkowitz says appointments can get very emotional, and she often slips out of character by the end. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.